Okay, I decided to switch my talks around because this is a more general talk, and then tomorrow I'll talk about surface waves and I'll try and illustrate some of the concepts that I'm supposed to get across to you today in that talk, and actually do some inverse problems in the lecture and maybe in the tutorial, assuming I can actually get it running. Okay. So this is in the seismology group of talks, but inverse problems, of course, are applicable to all aspects of geophysics, maybe even geochemistry, who knows. And there are a few things that you need to do when you talk about an inverse problem. You worry about existence, uniqueness, construction, and evaluation. And of course, this is what we spend 90% of our life doing, is making models, and we pretty much ignore the first two, and we do a little bit of the last, but probably not enough. I'll talk about this in the context of a specific problem in a minute. Now, there are certain classes of geophysical inverse problems. There are true linear problems, which I'll give a couple of examples of. They're usually pretty uninteresting. Almost everything that's interesting in geophysics is nonlinear. And what that means is that if you have some data related to some model, if you double the model, then you're going to double the data. All right, so I'll give you an example in a minute. And that's a linear inverse problem. And usually that's not the case. All right, if you double the seismic velocity inside the Earth, you don't double the travel times. Right, it's much more complicated than that. So then we go to the mildly nonlinear, which we hope we can linearize. So we worry about perturbations around some starting model, which we hope is in some sense close to the real Earth. And I'll talk a lot about those. And then there's the strongly nonlinear problems. And really, we don't have much machinery to deal with strongly nonlinear problems, except perhaps for intelligent search algorithms. So these are basically algorithms which solve what we call the forward problem, right? If you're given a model, compute some data. That's the forward problem. You always have to have solved the forward problem before you can do the inverse problem. And if you can do the forward problem, then you can search model space in an intelligent way and try and find a whole bunch of solutions which will fit the data. And that's what a genetic algorithm does, or evolutionary programming, or neighborhood algorithm of Sambridge, all the rest of those things. And they work reasonably well, providing you have a small number of model parameters, right? If you have a realistic number of model parameters, then forget it, and we're in deep trouble. Okay. For my experience, somewhere about 20 or less. So, I mean, you know, model space, when you're talking about 20 dimensions, gets pretty hard to search sensibly. Okay, so this is a linear problem. The mass and moment of inertia of the Earth, and I've already made this simpler because I've assumed that the Earth is spherically symmetric, okay, so that density is just a function of radius. And that's so I can write this generic form of the linear problem, where the model here is just some function of radius. I have some kernels, and I have some associated data, and always I will have some errors on my data. Now, it turns out, okay, and what distinguishes what I call an inverse problem from a parameter estimation problem is that in an inverse problem, we always have an infinite number of unknowns. Okay, the model is continuous. Okay, so you're never going to have enough data to solve the problem. All right, so the problem is always underdetermined in the sense that you never have enough data to solve it. Now, this is an example where if you double the density, you'll double the mass. Or if you double the density here, you'll double the moment of inertia factor. So that's a nice, simple model. Okay, now, when you think about existence, all right, obviously there's going to be some density model which will satisfy these two data. All right, now, so that's pretty clear. And we don't normally worry about existence. Now, if you were stupid enough to parameterize the model as just a constant density, all right, then you wouldn't be able to fit these data, all right, because you wouldn't fit the moment of inertia factor. So there would be classes of models that if you were stupid enough to use them, you would no longer be able to solve the problem. All right, and that's commonly what happens when you fail the existence test. Your fundamental model for solving the data is flawed in some way. Okay, for fitting the data is flawed in some way, and you need to make it better. Uniqueness is a simple question for linear inverse problems. if there's one model that will fit the data, there are an infinite number of models that will fit the data. All right, so you're out of luck. Okay, so then that's why model evaluation is so important, right? Because you have to decide what feature of the particular model that you got is likely to be represented inside the real Earth. Okay, so, all right, I'm going to talk a little bit about the inversion problem for Q, for modes, and this is what it looks like. And actually, there are two functions of radius here. Qk to the minus 1 is the, well, Qk is the quality factor of the kth mode. That tells you how fast a particular mode of oscillation of the Earth decays away. You don't really have to know any of this, right? This is just an inverse problem, right? So this is what this particular one is. The K and the M here are kernels, just like 4 pi r squared was a kernel for the mass of the Earth. These we can compute from a model of the Earth. We know those. And then Q kappa and Q mu are the quality factors in shear and compression through the Earth as a function of radius inside the Earth. They're what we're trying to determine. Okay? So these are our data, which have big error bars, actually. And this is, and we're trying to solve for Q mu and Q kappa with kernels that we can actually compute. These are the modes that are observed, and there are about a total of 1,000 modes that have been observed, and their frequencies have been measured quite precisely. Of about that 1,000, there are roughly 200 whose attenuation rates have been measured, and typically the attenuation rate is very hard to measure precisely. So to a sample of these guys, we've measured the attenuation rates, and they sample the Earth. Each mode samples the Earth in a different way. All right. So here's some examples of the observations. These are fundamental mode Qs. I'm actually plotting 1,000 over Q here because Q is typically on the order of 100 to 1,000. All right. So a Q, 1,000 over Q goes from 1 to 10. So it's a nice number. All right. So these are the observations. These are my QKs for fundamental modes. This is for fundamental toroidal modes. This is some overtones, and those are the radial modes and so on. So we have about 200 of these, and these are what the kernels look like. The black line here is the shear energy density, that's that M in my original equation, and the dashed line is the K. Let me just go back. So we've got the K and the M here. So the solid line is the M of R. All right, so that tells you the radial weighting inside the Earth. So a fundamental mode is dominantly shear energy. The black is the shear energy. And it's concentrated towards the surface. This is the center of the Earth. This is the inner core boundary. This is the core mantle boundary. And this is the surface. And then we have all these other modes that sample the Earth in more complicated ways. All right. And because we have this variety of modes, there's a chance that we'll be able to learn something about the depth distribution of attenuation inside the Earth. Okay. All right. Now, you don't always have to parameterize. Okay, that's probably the first thing that you would do given an inverse problem is decide how you're going to divide up Q mu and Q kappa as a function of depth inside the Earth. Well, you don't have to do that. You can actually do what we call a data space solution, and that is you expand the model here. This is a model perturbation, but never mind. In terms of the kernels. All right, so you plug that into your equation up there, and you get a little equation that looks like this, where this grand matrix here is an n by n matrix, where n is the number of data. Okay, you can then invert this grand matrix to get the A's, and then you can recover your model. Okay, and you haven't parameterized. Of course, you have to be able to do these integrals here, which means that somehow or other these kernels have been interpolated onto some knots for doing the integrals. So there's an implicit parameterization in there when you do this. But in principle, this is not parameterized. The problem with doing data space solutions is that you end up with n by n matrices. So 1,000 data is fine. All right? If we're solving for the elastic structure of the Earth using free oscillation frequencies, 1,000 by 1,000 matrix is fine. If you get up to 10,000 data, then you're beginning to, life is beginning to get tough. Okay, if you get it to 100,000 data, then you're in serious trouble. So there's a limited number of problems that you can do with it, but if you can do it, then this works just fine. One issue that you have is that this matrix may not be well conditioned. And it will not be well conditioned if you have lots of data which tell you the same thing about the Earth. Okay, so they're basically repeat measurements in some sense. And that's what we have with fundamental modes. Okay, if you look at the shear energy densities, you look at them, we've measured very precisely the modes, the Qs of the modes along here. But if you look at their shear energy densities, they all basically look very similar. This is from now from the Kormal boundary up to the surface of the Earth. So G1 here is the shear energy density for 0S21, and G18 is the shear energy density for 0S38. And you can make any one of these from the other 17 to a part in 10 of the 6. Okay? So if you wanted to say that you have independent data for 0S21 to 0S38, you would have had to make those Q measurements to a part in 10 of the 6. All right? And let me tell you, that's impossible. With Q measurements, you're lucky to get a few percent. All right, so these measurements that you've made here are not giving you independent information about the Earth. And there's a technique for taking your data and forming orthogonal data out of them and ranking them by their precision. It's called ranking and winnowing. And if you do that with the mode Q data, you go from 210 measurements down to 20 measurements which are orthogonal to one another, which have precisions of better than 10%. Okay? So that tells you that you can't learn very much about the Earth from that data set. You basically have 10 degrees of freedom with which to play, 20 degrees of freedom with which to play. All right, so that's bad news. So this is an old model that came out of that kind of analysis. However, you can equally well fit the Q data. So this is Q mu and Q kappa, the two different models. Q kappa is the dashed line, and we know very little about bulk attenuation inside the Earth, except that we need it to satisfy the radial mode attenuations. But that's about it. The solid lines are the two models, shear attenuation, and you can basically get away with a six-layer model. All right. So I mean, we didn't need to parameterize this, but this tells you that you can basically get away with a six-layer model with very high attenuation in the asthenosphere, and that you need that to fit the data. Okay, so that's an unfortunate inverse problem, if you like, in the sense that you do a lot of work and you actually end up learning not very much about the Earth. And that's typical of attenuation problems, as Colleen will doubtless tell you soon. Okay. All right, so you made a model, and then I've told you you've got to evaluate it. Right? If you don't evaluate it, you're wasting your time. So how do you do that with these continuous models? You haven't parameterized. Okay, what do you do? Well, you do something called Backus-Gilbert theory. And there is a PDF on the web and a paper on the web discussing the application of Backus-Gilbert theory to the mode frequency elastic structure inverse problem. But this is what the basic concept is. It's really very simple. You have your original equation up here. This is for a linear problem. We just take a linear combination of the data. All right, that means we have a linear combination of the kernels on this side. Okay, we try and choose the AIs here to make this combination be spiked. We're going to call it A. The sigma AI GI of R is just A. We're going to try and make it spiked at some radius, R naught. All right, so we're just going to do a little optimization problem to choose the AIs to do that. And then this value here, the m bar of r naught, will be some radial integral, but with most of the integral around the radius r naught. And there will be an average of the model over some resolving length, this resolving length here. Okay? Now, unfortunately, there are errors in the data. All right? So when I take a combination of the data to make this model average here, that will have an error. And its error will be given by this. Okay, this is just, well, it would be sigma AI, sigma I, except I'm not allowed to do that with errors, right? I have to work with variances, so everything has to be squared, right? So that's why the error is the square root of the variances. And so I also want my AIs here to make this error be small, all right, so that my average here is precise, okay? So I want my AIs to do two things. I want this to be precise, and I want this to be spike-like. All right, and it turns out that those two things are mutually exclusive. I can't do both things at once. And the more spike-like I make this, the more erroneous my average is. All right, the broader I allow this to be, the more precise that average is, because I'm averaging over a larger range. I mean, it makes perfectly intuitive sense, I hope. All right, so you get a trade-off curve between the error on the model here and the width or spread of this kernel. It looks something like this, and you're supposed to choose some AI, group of AIs, set of AIs, which gives you a solution, which is a compromise. Okay, that's all that Backus-Gilbert is. It's really a very simple idea. This is what it looks like when you linearize for the mode frequencies in terms of the elastic structure and the density inside the Earth and the seismic velocities. And this is just to remind me to tell you that typically we're linearizing a problem. So we're working around some starting model, M sub zero in this case, and our data are observed frequencies minus the frequencies for this M sub zero. All right, so, and I'm hoping that when I perturb the Earth, I can make predictions in the frequencies that are within the linear range. The assumption is then that this term in this expansion, which is of order delta M squared, I can neglect. Now, it turns out that mode frequencies are often very precisely measured, sometimes to a part in 10 to the 6. And this term here can easily be bigger than the formal error on the data. So your definition of nonlinear is a little funky here. I mean, if you're ignoring terms in the representation of the data that are commensurate with your errors, then you're in trouble. All right? So we often have to dumb down the data and increase the errors a little bit if we want to do a linear analysis and ignore the higher order terms. So there's a PDF on the web. These are examples of making resolving kernels for density, and here the error percent, the error on the local average that you get out of this has been fixed to be 0.5%. And so these are for different depths inside the Earth. And you can see we do a pretty good job of localizing information about density everywhere, except maybe perhaps we're in the inner core. This is the inner core here. This is the lower mantle. There are more lines on here. Excuse me for copying you. There are more lines on here than just one, because the data are also sensitive to the compression velocity and the shear velocity. And now you make combinations of the data that localize information about density and try and make this combination of data completely insensitive to the shear velocity and the compression velocity. Okay, so these other lines in here should be zero, which if you have done things perfectly, you've made a combination of data which samples only density and is now completely insensitive the shear velocity and compression velocity. So it's a little more complicated than the 1D problem I showed you, but not much. And to show you width. And so this is a summary of what you can say about the Earth, the density and resolution inside the Earth. This is the width of that resolving kernel for different error levels in the local average. So the top curve here is for local averages which have an error of 0.5% in density. And as you go up in radius inside the Earth, you'll find that the width here is on the order of about 180 kilometers. So in the transition zone, we have widths here for 0.5% error on the order of 150, 140 kilometers. So we actually can't do a very good job of saying what the density is inside the transition zone for a 1D model for mode frequency. We can only get about 0.5% if we're prepared to average over about half the width of the transition zone. All right? If you're prepared to average over a larger range, well, that's the best you can do here. So that's just a fundamental problem with modes, is that you can localize information reasonably well, but you're always limited to about 100, 150 kilometers in the best of cases, at least with the current mode data set. So this is typically what density looks like. If you make these local averages and plot them and compare them with models of density in the lower mantle, then everything pretty much agrees. Okay. All right, so that's the non-parameterized world of inverse problems. In practice, the first thing we do is to parameterize, because we just have too much data. All right, you can't work in data space anymore. So we have to parameterize. And then it's a different kind of problem. Typically what you do then is, what do we mean by parameterization? Well, now we expand the model in some basis set. I'm doing everything in one dimension here, but these, of course, in tomography, these basis functions are functions of R theta and phi, because you're doing a 3D problem. But in this simple 1D case, where this is what we've got. We plug that into the top equation. We compute the integral over R of GI FJ, that's AIJ, and then we have to solve D equals A dot A, where the A's now are in the model expansion in terms of the basis set. And the reason we do this is because we can choose a much smaller number of basis functions to represent the model than the number of data. All right, and we're going to end up solving systems which are typically M by M rather than N by N. So if I have 300,000 data, I can maybe parameterize my model with 10,000 unknowns, and I'll be working with matrices which are 10,000 by 10,000, not 300,000 by 300,000. Okay, so that's why we parameterize. Now, when you do this, and you have more equations than unknowns, your problem may be formally overdetermined, but almost certainly it will be ill-conditioned. There will be parts of your model which are not well constrained by the data. Okay, and that will be apparent when you come and try and invert this matrix A. All right. So now we have a finite number of unknowns, and so now we're doing parameter estimation. And if you look in your local library, you'll find shelves and shelves of books all about parameter estimation. Parameterization, you can do this in lots of ways. Those F functions, you can choose them in many different ways. I'm going to illustrate most of this talk with examples from global tomography. And it's been traditional to use spherical harmonics and these YLMs here. So you expand your model, which is a function of R, theta, and phi here, in terms of some coefficients, which are functions of radius, and these spherical harmonics, which are functions of theta and phi. And these are just some examples. You know, Y00 is a constant. Y10, it looks like a dipole. Y20 looks like ellipticity. And then these are the other harmonics. And as you go up in L here, the lower number, these things get wigglier and wigglier. And I'll talk about these tomorrow in a bit more in the context of surface wave analysis, high L. And then it starts looking like traveling waves. The problem with spherical harmonics is that all of these functions are global, right? A YLM covers the whole Earth. So if I have a ray that goes from a source to a receiver, and I measure its travel time, and it samples just a very small part of the Earth, it samples every damn spherical harmonic, all right? So I get a full matrix when I do this, and I can't take advantage of the fact that my ray only samples a very small part of the model. And that's because I'm using a global basis rather than a local basis. Now, if you look at a spherical harmonic expansion, if you stop at degree L, then there are L plus 1 squared coefficients. Okay, so, and the matrices are dense, so I can't take advantage of sparsity. So if I want to be able to do inversions on my desktop computer, I'm limited to, say, about 10,000 parameters. If I divide the mantle into 20 layers, which would be about right, then I can only, from this L plus 1 squared term, then I can only do an L equal 20 expansion in each layer. And you probably all know Jean's formula, which says that L plus a half is the circumference of the Earth divided by the wavelength. So this means that with this kind of number of parameters, with a 20-layer mantle model, I can get a smallest wavelength of 2,000 kilometers. And in this day and age, 2,000 kilometers just doesn't sound very interesting, right? It's just not going to do it. So if we're going to actually be able to solve these problems on our desktop computers, then it makes sense to use local bases. And you can go to much bigger systems, and you can take advantage of the sparsity of the matrices, the fact that your data only sample a very small part of the model, all right? So you can use pixels or voxels, whatever you want to call them, or local splines or whatever, all kinds of local parameterizations. But this day and age, we have so much data that we basically, and we're interested in reasonably high resolution structure, then this is the only way to go. Okay. All right, this is what everybody worries about, and I'm illustrating this finding a model with using a singular value decomposition, which is something we can't actually do because our matrices are too big. But it just illustrates a couple of things about the solution that I want to get across. All right, so you want to solve the system at the top. You minimize some, if you would do least squares, you would minimize the sum of squares of the residuals, and this would be the answer, x hat is a transpose a to the minus 1 a transpose d. You've probably all seen that. The matrix A has what we call a condition number, which if you do an eigenvalue analysis of the matrix is the ratio of the largest to the smallest eigenvalue. And if that is big, then it means that the matrix is unstable. Right? There are parts of the model you are not constraining. And this inversion, the A transpose A to the minus 1, will be very unstable. And A transpose A has squared the condition number of A, and so it makes it much, much worse. All right, so you really don't want to deal with A transpose A if you can avoid it. You'd like to deal just with A. You don't want to square the matrix. It makes the whole inversion much more unstable. All right, so you go from having an eigenvalue from a range of 1 to 10 to the minus 6, the range of 1 to 10 to the minus 12, right? And that's not good. Yeah. I mean that the solution will blow up. You will get nonsense. If you just solve this solution here, what you have are some elements of the model are basically multiplied by zero, or some very small number. So they're not constrained. So they can be very large and not affect the fit to the data. Okay? So that's what's meant by an ill-conditioned system. Okay, so SVD, you convert this thing into right and left-hand eigenvectors, and I don't really expect you to know too much about this, but this would be the typical way that you would construct the inverse, which we call a generalized inverse of A, using an SVD. And now the reason you might want to do this is that if A is ill-conditioned, then it will have very small singular values. This lambda matrix in the middle here is a diagonal matrix of non-zero diagonal elements, which may have a very large range. And if you have small ones, and you add them into this expansion here, and the small ones will contribute much, much more to the inverse than the large ones. All right? And they're associated with parts of the model that are not well constrained. Okay, and you can see that by computing the model covariance matrix. Okay, if you take a linear combination of data to make a model, which is what you're doing here, right, then to compute the errors on this thing, you have to take the same combinations of the covariance matrix of the data. Right, it's just propagation of errors. Everybody know about propagation of errors? So what I would typically do is divide these equations through by the errors so that it would be a datum plus or minus 1, right? Datum divided by error plus or minus 1. My covariance matrix would be I. And then this would be my model covariance matrix because I have to do A plus on both sides of it. And so I go through the algebra here, and my model covariance matrix has a lambda to the minus 2 in it. All right, so the small singular values are going to really make large contributions to the model covariance matrix. So I will end up with, if I include them, I end up with a model which is very uncertain. Okay, so what people do is they just say, okay, I'm going to do this, but I'm going to ignore the small guys. I'm just going to truncate the singular values. And I'm not going to, if the singular value gets below 10 to the minus 3 of the largest one, I'm just going to ignore that completely and not include it. All right, and then they would be excluded from here, and your model would come out with smaller errors. Okay, this is kind of a stupid way to regularize a problem, but it's one way to do it. Now, a consequence of that is that you no longer exactly satisfy the resolution characteristics of the inverse problem. So if you look at x here is a plus d, well, you know that d is ax, so you just plug that into here, and you get x hat is a plus a times x. So this is a matrix which takes the true model vector and gives you what your recovered model vector is. This guy is called the resolution matrix, this R here. Okay, now, and if you do the singular value decomposition stuff for A plus here, that becomes VV transpose. Now, if this were perfectly well conditioned and you took all the singular values, then VV transpose would just be I. Right? You would have a perfectly resolved problem. X hat would equal X. As soon as you start throwing singular values away, this will not be equal to I, and every element of your recovered model vector will be a linear combination of all the elements of the real model vector. This will probably be close to something which is 1, which is close to I, but it's going to have off-diagonal elements, and you'll basically get smearing of the model into adjacent model parameters. Okay? So there's a trade-off here between the model error and your ability to resolve structure. And you're controlling that, in this case, by throwing away singular values. That's not a very good way to do it, but that's one way of doing it. And the reason it's not a very good way to do it is that you don't really know in what sense your final model is optimal, right? I like to know when I get a model that it satisfies some optimization criterion. This is the best model in some sense, okay? And the way you can do that is by explicitly adding a regularization condition here. So on the top here, I have the standard least squares. This is the function I want to minimize. Sum of squares of residuals. And then D here is some roughening operator. All right, so DX takes the model and makes it rough. And then I square it. And the lambda here is just a parameter I can adjust to adjust the amount of smoothing relative to fitting the data. And the reason that you want a roughening operator is because you're minimizing this thing. Right, so you want to minimize the roughness or maximize the smoothness of the model. So D would probably be some difference operator like this that would roughen everything up. So you can go through the algebra, and then this is what the equation looks like, and the final solution looks like this, okay? And if lambda was zero in this x hat equation here, you'd come back straight to the least square solution, okay? And everything is fine. And as you increase lambda, you're going to increase the smoothing more and more. And so now we have a new generalized inverse, which looks like this, and you can go back and compute the error, the model covariance matrix, and the resolution using this generalized inverse. And again, you'll get this trade-off between smoothness and the precision with which you're recovering the model. Now, I've been preaching, don't square matrices, right? So you don't actually solve that thing up there. What you would do would be to solve something that looks like this. The same as that second equation there. If you multiply through by the transpose of this matrix, you'll get exactly that up there. But this then you would solve using an SVD or something that can handle rectangular matrices, or in reality something that's an iterative solver that will handle huge matrices, because this is what we're faced with, having very large matrices here. But this is exactly numerically equivalent to that, except we would be solving without squaring the condition number. Everybody happy? Yeah, all right. People, okay, so like I said, matrices are usually too big to use direct inversion techniques. The direct inversion technique is QR or an SVD or something like that. It's something you take out of LINPACK and you stick your matrix in and out comes the answer. It's the operation in MATLAB, which you should never, ever use. All right. Okay. All right, so I don't know what I want to talk about. All right, so there's a complex sequence in the notes where I talk about iterative techniques, and I don't think I really want to talk. I just want to give you an example. Let me just give you an example. So if you really want to know about iterative techniques, read the notes. I assume you all managed to get them. Iterative techniques, you start in some place and you start wandering around model space trying to find where you want to be, okay? And the way to think about this is to think about the misfit function, all right? At any point if I have y equals ax, all right? I choose a certain value of x and then I compute y minus ax, I'm going to have some residual and I can square that, right? And that function there basically defines a surface. It's a misfit surface. It's got hills and valleys. And you know, I'm sitting on this surface. I'm trying to decide in which direction to go to get towards the minimum. I want to find the minimum misfit. All right. And so I can choose all my different x's to go downhill as best I can and get to the minimum. Right? And that's what iterative techniques want to do. Now, in the notes, it describes how you compute well, the gradient of this surface, this misfit surface, actually just gives you the slope, and the negative of that gradient gives you the direction of steepest descent. All right, so you can actually compute what the direction is to go downhill. This is like sitting on a surface here with your skis on and stupidly pointing your skis straight downhill. Of course, you would never ever do that, right? But if you did that, that would be the direction of steepest descent. And you can compute that. Okay? And you can compute how far you need to go in that direction to minimize this misfit function. Okay? So you would go in that direction for one step and see where you are, and then you look where you were and you say, whoops, now the direction's in this way, I'll go down in that direction and see where I get. And so I wrote this little program to demonstrate this, which is interesting because I don't understand the way it behaves. So, whoops, where am I? All right, so I'm going to make a square matrix here. I'm going to make a model vector. All right, so I'm going to solve this little system here. Here's my square matrix times the model vector is equal to this. Now, what I'm trying to find is this model vector. Okay? And here's my data, and here's my matrix. And so what I do is I'm standing, I start at point 0, 0, 0, and I ask, okay, what is the direction of steepest descent? All right? And I find that direction, and I go the appropriate amount to minimize the misfit function in that direction. And this is my answer, 6.89, 8.04, 9.03. Not bad. Right? So let's go again. So we turn our skis, and we go downhill again. Oh, it's even better. This is the misfit between the actual solution and the... So the trouble with this is that as we get downhill, we can start suddenly going back up again. So we're getting worse. Oh, well. Actually, it can happen really quickly. I was playing with this last night. I won't tell you what time. All right, so this one, this is a slightly different problem. So the first time, I'm trying to get 4, 5, and 6 here, and now I'm already going backwards, right? So what is happening here is sometimes if you get in a flat space, the direction is not particularly well defined, and you can predict that you should go for a really long distance to get the optimal answer. All right, I think that's what's happening here. And so you can start banging around in space. You know, the traditional way of describing this is you're in some valley, and you're skiing across and across and across. You know, you don't actually go down the middle of the valley. You're just bouncing around, and you never get there. All right. So the way to get out of this is to actually think about what you're doing. What you're doing is you're choosing directions to go every time you do an iterate. Right now, if you could choose those directions to be orthogonal to one another in some sense, then you would only need a finite number of iterations to get to the final answer, right? Which would be the number of parameters in the inversion. Because if you have an orthogonal basis, you can always solve in exactly that number. Well, it turns out that the directions that you choose are not orthogonal in the standard sense. They are called conjugate directions. Okay, and I it's explained in the notes. And so these kinds of techniques are called conjugate gradient techniques. And they do make a set of directions which are actually effectively orthogonal to one another. And so you only ever need, in my case, with three steps here, you only ever need, with a 3x3 matrix, you only ever need three steps. Okay, so they're not really iterative techniques when you think about it in that way. So I have a little program that does this. It's about 5 lines longer than the first one. So the first step you take is steepest descent. Okay, so that's exactly the same as we had the first time. Then we iterate, and it's pretty good. Then we're done. Third step, we're done. Right, we are there. That's all we need is three steps because there are three parameters. All right, so what people use when they're using iterative techniques these days is they're using these techniques based on conjugate gradient. You know, a whole slew of these things, and a lot of them are designed to work with rectangular matrices, and more importantly, to work with sparse rectangular matrices. So you can solve really big problems with these things. Okay, so that's the fun. So if you guys can figure out why it was doing that strange business, then you get an A. All right, how are we doing here? Okay, so we're not going to talk about that. All right, so I'm going to show you some examples now. So this example is using S-wave mantle tomography, and there's a whole bunch of travel times, S travel times, SS, SCS, all the rest, surface waves, free oscillation, 4-degree boxes, if you like. The layers are 100 kilometers thick in the upper mantle, down the transition zone, through the transition zone, then 200 kilometers in the lower mantle. We end up with about 50,000 model parameters and about 300,000 data. And this is a medium-sized tomography problem. You can solve it on your little laptop here because everything's very sparse. All right, so it's nice. okay, the conjugate gradient technique that I use is LSQR. And for this model here, which has something like 50,000 model parameters, you don't have to iterate 50,000 times to get the solution. That's the whole nice thing about this, is that the solution converges much more quickly than that. And that's what your hope is, right? And in fact, this solution has converged after about, less than 100 iterations. Now, so what you're doing is you're making models, you're going in these conjugate gradient directions, and you can, at each step, you can compute how well you're fitting the data and how well you've converged. You've got to be really careful about this, because this is the misfit to the data, normalized to 1 here, all right? And after 20 iterations, you're basically done, okay? But I kept going, all right? And the reason I kept going was that my model vector was still increasing in size. And this is what almost always happens. The model vector gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And it's just the sum of the squares of the elements in the model vector. And as you iterate on, it takes a lot longer to actually stabilize. And I think it's because you're including smoothing in this thing. And it's not until you get to later iterations that the effect of the smoother really comes into play. So when I decide to stop the iterations here in this technique, I use the convergence of the model size, not the convergence of the misfit. If you can use the convergence of the misfit, you would stop way too soon. And you would not have a model which actually satisfies the problem that you set up, optimizing some misfit to the data with some regularization. That's what you want. You want the solution that you know is the solution to the optimization problem that you would have got if you'd had a machine that could have done a 50,000 by 50,000 direct inversion. Okay, so this is what it looks like. This is a view through the manhole with plus or minus 1% isovelocity surfaces and shear velocity. This is the South Pacific superplume. Got to be careful. This is the Great African Plume. This is the Azores over here, and then there's this blue curtain of stuff around the Pacific. You all know what the mantle looks like, right? I'm talking about inverse problems here, but in this particular inverse problem, what is absolutely critical is the data that goes into it, your data coverage and the data types. It really doesn't matter so much whether you're using banana donuts or rays or anything else. Truth isn't here, right? I can say that. But if you don't include a whole bunch of different data types, you're not going to get the right answer. In particular, what if you take away the surface waves? All right, so there are a lot of surface waves in this inversion, and they are the things that are really constraining the uppermost mantle. There are body waves that sample that, but they're not really doing it. So if you take away the surface waves, this is what happens. So just look at the top of this model. Right. These are slices through the Earth, I should say, plus or minus 2% on the scale here. And red is slow relative to the mean at different depths inside the Earth, all the way from top to this is the core mantle boundary. Okay, so if you take the surface waves away, then you just lose the top of the model completely. All right, and if you look at the correlation between the two models, it kind of is gone. It starts to disappear about 1,000 kilometers, and the two models are completely uncorrelated above that. And the blue line here is the model with the surface waves. And look at the amplitudes. This is the amplitudes of function of depth. They're way, way higher. And actually, I know they're underestimated as well. So you may think you've got the upper mantle constrained using SS or triple S or things like that. But you don't. Right? You have to have something like surface waves in there to do it. All right. Now, to do this problem, where I'm using an iterative technique. Right, so I don't have singular values and singular vectors. How do I go about computing my model covariance matrix and my resolution matrix? Right, I've lost all the machinery that I normally would use to compute those things. okay, and I haven't done an SVD or anything like that. Well, there are a variety of ways that you can get around that. You can compute. There are our ways of actually computing selected singular values and singular vectors using SVD pack, which is available subroutine package. It's not particularly stable. It uses the Langstroth algorithm, which is notoriously unstable. One thing that you can do for the resolution matrix, if you remember, the resolution matrix is the matrix that maps the true model vector into the model vector that you actually got out of the inversion. And one thing that you can do is what we call a spike test, and that is that you make all of the model elements be zero except for one. Right? You then dot that model element into your A matrix and make some synthetic data. You then invert that synthetic data. Right? And if everything were perfect, it should come out with all of the model elements being zero except for that one that you had turned on. Right? And that, but it won't. There'll be little pixels turned on around it. It'll be smeared. All right. Now, what you've effectively done is computed one row and column of the resolution matrix. Right. So if you were prepared to do this test 50,000 times, you could actually compute the whole resolution matrix this way. But, you know, nobody wants to do that. But if there's a part of the model that you're really interested in, a spike test is the way to go. You know, you can actually look at the resolution in that one particular place. Now, we're usually too impatient to do that. So instead of using a spike, just turning on one model element, we usually turn on a lot of model elements simultaneously and make some pretty pattern that we want to recover, like a checkerboard, all right? And it's just really because we want to get a lot of information quickly, all right? But it's the same principle. You make a model which you know it looks like a checkerboard. You make some synthetic data. You invert that synthetic data using the same algorithm, all the same weights that you did with the real data, and see what you get back. And I'll show you some examples in a minute. Now, some people, and it always makes me nervous, is they'll do an inversion and they'll find a beautiful Farallon's lap, right? And say, wow, look at that. Is it resolved? So they make a synthetic model, which is a beautiful Farallon's lap, and ask, can I resolve this beautiful Farallon's lap? Right? And of course they can, right? Because you haven't learned anything. All the smearing that went on in the original modeling is probably going on with the synthetic test, but you can't see it. Right, so some people swear that you should do that, but it makes me nervous. Okay, so that's how we do resolution. We do it with a bunch of different tests, like a checkerboard test, a spike test, ways of computing approximations to the resolution matrix. Now, the model errors is a little harder. If you really want to look at the whole covariance matrix of the model, which is enormous, right, then you're in trouble. However, if you're only interested in an error on a particular pixel, right, then life is much easier. So what you do is you do an inversion. With your iterative inversion, you get one model. Okay, you say, then you add random numbers to your data vector with the right statistics, and you invert it again. You get another model. And you do it again and again and again. And you have 50 or 100 models, right? And then you take the mean and the standard deviation of those models. Right? And it turns out that if you've used the right statistics in the stuff you added, the random numbers you added to your data, then you'll get very good approximations to the standard deviations on the model that way. So that's kind of a Monte Carlo approach, right? You're just adding random numbers to data vectors and inverting. And if you have smoothed a lot, then your model will not be very sensitive to errors in the data. And your 50 models that you get out will be very like each other, and the errors will be small. If you haven't smoothed very much, right, then the models will be quite variable. They'll be quite sensitive to changes in the data vector. And your standard deviations will be much larger. And there'll be this trade-off again between the degree of smoothing and the uncertainty in the model that comes out. And this is one way of doing this. And all of this stuff you're going to do tomorrow. Yeah. A checkerboard test when you're using Sprott harmonics is a spike test in the wave number domain, right? I mean, that's exactly what it is. So it's whichever way you want to go, all right? And there it's probably more realistic to try and do a spike test when you're using global basis functions. because some of the data actually have antipodal ambiguities, and you know your spike can actually have something on the other side of the Earth when you try and recover it, so it's a little worrisome. Ah, well, yes. Gaussian, of course. They don't match ISC errors very well. Okay, it depends. Not too bad. I mean, we're a bit long-tailed, but we're not grossly long-tailed. All right. I mean, you could be clever about it if you wanted to, and actually, maybe in yours. Absolutely. Okay, this is just to show you, what this is a representation of how many times a pixel is hit by a ray in the lower mantle, and in the upper mantle actually too. And so black is good and white is bad. And this is going through the mantle down to the base of the mantle, and you can see, this is a slightly old plot, but it's still true that there are portions of the southern hemisphere at the base of the mantle which are not particularly well sampled by our data sets. And that's just a consequence of the geometry of sources and receivers on the surface of the Earth. Right now, again, it doesn't matter what theory you're going to use, parts of the lower mantle in the southern hemisphere are going to be poorly resolved. Okay? This is just the body wave density, but the surface waves, I don't care about the top because we've got the surface waves too. And then what's really controlling the structure in the top. Okay, so this is what we input. So these are a bunch of different layers, all the layers in the lower mantle of the model. And this is what we put in for our checkerboard test, and then we make synthetic data, dot it with the A matrix, make synthetic data, and then we do the inversion exactly the way we do the real inversion with the real data, and that's what we get back. Okay, so we go from this to this, and we get 70% of the power back. And while people say, well, why don't you just multiply your model by, you know, 1 over 70 and we'll be done? And of course, that is not the way it works. Right. If I had used a larger wavelength checkerboard pattern, I would have gotten much better amplitude recovery, much more closer to 100%. If I'd chosen a smaller size for my checkerboard pattern, I would have gotten much worse amplitude recovery. All right. And here you can see the amplitude recovery is varying. It's almost 100% in some places, but then in the southern hemisphere, it's not so good. But the pattern is recovered well, right? So we're actually doing a pretty good job of getting the pattern back. Top of the lower mantle, we do even better, which might surprise you. The bottom, all right, and that's again because we just don't have good constraints on the bottom of the southern hemisphere. We're getting better. This is a slightly old plot, but we're getting better, but it's kind of incremental, and we're slowly getting there. Uska here has been measuring diffracted waves, which has improved our coverage of the lowermost mantle quite a lot, so there are ways you can get around it, but right now, the southern hemisphere and the lowermost mantle is not particularly well constrained. So if you're interested in the South Pacific superplume, for example, which is this guy, this is what one of my students called the South Pacific seismosaurus, whatever. Anyway, so this is what, if you look at the checkerboard patterns, then they just get worse and worse and worse as you go down to so these are slices through the South Pacific superplume. And you can see here that the worst resolution is right down at the bottom where this thing is kind of mangled into one big lump. As you go up and it splits into little pieces, that's where your resolution gets better. All right. So actually, when you look at this thing, the fact that this is in little blobs here is probably better resolved than the fact that they're all smooched together at the bottom, just because of the data coverage. Okay, so, all right, now we're talking about the transition zone. Ooh. Transition zone is a problem for us because, at least for us, my group, it's a problem because the surface waves are what constrain the top of the model, and they're beginning to run out of oomph by the time you get to the transition zone. And the body waves are all turning in the lower mantle, and so they're going pretty much vertically through the transition zone. Not quite, they give a little bit of resolution. But this is what you get. So, basically you cannot really, the amplitude is smeared between the upper transition zone and the lower transition zone. These are only 100 kilometer thick layers here, so the resolution is harder to do in the upper mantle. And you can see that where there's body wave data, you do actually get some amplitude recovery. But there is quite good pattern recovery, even though you don't get the amplitude particularly well. The amplitude is smeared between this layer, the layer above, and to some extent the top of the lower mantle, the very top of the lower mantle. And you can compare that with what's going on in the mid-mantle, where there's almost no smearing into adjacent layers. So the transition zone has issues in terms of resolution. We don't have overtones in here, no. And overtone dispersion data is something that I've never had a great... Yeah, I mean, the transition zone is certainly better resolved by being able to do waveform modeling because you can handle all the triplications that happen in the data. And they're very complicated waveforms. And so waveform modeling can help in this particular case. But anyway, it's interesting that this is the front and back hemisphere on the transition zone. And this is the first place where in the models where we actually see subduction with any degree of confidence. Above this, we don't really see subduction in the models. So I'm not sure exactly. I think it's semi-resolved in pattern, and it's almost certainly underestimated in amplitude. Okay. What are we doing here? Final thing is errors. So these are the kinds of errors that you get. They are at least an order of magnitude with the inverse parameters that I used. When you do this Monte Carlo business and estimate the errors, the errors are typically of order of magnitude smaller than the model itself. So they are not an issue, right? So conceivably, you could actually change where you're working on this trade-off curve to give yourself a little bit more resolution, so you damp less, right, and you allow the errors to get a little bit bigger, right? So you can move around a little bit, maybe, and find another place in model space which gives you a little bit more resolution and still have acceptable errors. Okay, so because our errors are still pretty small. Okay. All right. So as you will find out tomorrow, what you choose for your final model is still pretty subjective. And if we really knew what the errors were in our data, there would be some objective criterion for deciding whether or not you'd fit the data. But we really don't know to within 50% or so, what the errors on our data are. So there's a little bit of leeway there. I want to emphasize that data coverage is the main thing that in this particular problem that constrains things. Smoothing is still necessary, and it leads to trade-offs between resolution and error, and you will see this for yourself tomorrow. And finally, beware that tomorrow people leave. Okay, how about that? Actually, yes. Sumatra was really good at improving 0S2 and 0S3 and 0S4, and particularly the attenuation rates. But most of the modes we already had. All right, so it was not a massive revelation by any means, because one earthquake is not terribly good at exciting all the singlets of a particular mode, and if you've got 15 magnitude 8s, it's not as good as a magnitude 9.3, but it's getting close, and we've already taken those modes apart. So it didn't make a vast difference. But it certainly helped with the very low frequency modes, particularly for the attenuation rates. Yeah, you could do, why are we doing L2 norm rather than something else? And you can design iterative techniques that will do other norms. And certainly when you start doing the genetic algorithm type thing, you can choose any norm you like. And if you think that you are subject to outliers in the data, then you should certainly use an L1 norm or something more robust than an L2 norm. We're pretty careful about getting rid of the outliers in our data before we do these inversions. And at the end, the residuals do look pretty Gaussian when you're done. So it's not totally stupid. Yeah. No, it's just the sum of squares of the model parameters, the Euclidean length of the model vector. All right, it's just a measure of whether or not you've iterated towards a stable model parameter, model vector. Yep. Okay. How does the checkerboard really work? Okay, well, what you do, you're solving. So what you do is you make an X vector, which is a checkerboard, in one particular layer. All right? So you make this be an input. And then, so you put an XC in here for checkerboard, you make some synthetic data. All right? And then you recover X hat is A inverse, however you did it, times DC. All right? So this is the data vector that you got from the checkerboard. All right? And so hopefully this would look exactly like that. All right, and of course it doesn't because of all the smoothing that's going on and the lack of data coverage and all those things. So you're saying, okay, if I knew what the pattern looked like perfectly, how is that distorted by doing this inversion? All right, and you just do it for different layers. How much does this checkerboard smooth into layers above and below? You know, all that kind of thing you can look at. Am I using the right kind of smoothing laterally and radially? So it's a check on, it's a sanity check on whether you're doing things in a sensible fashion. You know, if you over smooth, you would apparently think you had super errors, but when you did a checkerboard test, you'd find you hadn't resolved anything, and you'll see that tomorrow when you do the inversion. It's kind of cute. Well, that's kind of what I was doing here. When I show you the whole model. So these guys, for example, all right? So there you're seeing this, the smearing into adjacent layers, in which case it's that layer and that layer, actually. So there's a little bit. Sorry? Yeah, you can. And you mean doing a plume test? Yeah, I mean, you can put any pattern in you like and ask if it's recovered. You know, you can put in the Southwest Pacific slabs and ask if you can recover them, right? This is an attempt to be moderately objective, right? It's not an attempt to try and find something that comes out of the inversions that you're doing. I mean, ideally what you would do would be to turn on one pixel here and ask how well each pixel is resolved, but that would be a lot of overhead. Yeah. No. On the misfit? If you stop here, the model doesn't look anything like the final model. Why am I continuing? The reason I am continuing is that I'm trying to get the solution to the problem that I posed. Right? What is the model that optimizes this particular problem with a particular value of lambda? Right? This is, if I stopped here, it would be like truncating a singular value decomposition. Right? I would end up with a model, but I had no idea what that model optimized. Okay? I mean, I can change lambda and find. If you look at these models, they look like nothing. Well, that's where the smoothing. Yeah, there are a lot of things that you do with this kind of problem before you invert it. And typically, people don't invert something that looks like this. They have a little weight matrix in here and a W minus one in here. And this is called preconditioning. And you can be very clever about the way you precondition to improve the conditioning of this matrix. And it's very like evening out the sampling in some ways. Right. And so the singular value range of the preconditioned matrix will be much smaller than of the original matrix, and it speeds up convergence and really does a good job. So there are tricks in there that you do to make this whole process go faster, which is very much like what Adam is saying. You're trying to correct in some way for the deficiencies of the matrix. But then, of course, you end up with a model vector which you immediately put the deficiencies back into at the end. But that's just the nature of the problem. Right. That's why you've got to keep going until the model converges. It's disturbing. And parts of the model do look similar to the final model. They're the parts that really affect the fit to the data. Right? But a large part of the model, which only has a much smaller impact on the fit to the data, is quite different. And that takes longer to come into play. And also the fact that the smoother is coming in, and on those parts in particular, takes longer to come in. But I would still claim that it's better to end up with a solution to the problem that you know, rather than to stopping here and ending up with some solution to a problem that you don't know what you've solved. Right? If I go to here, and then I solve that same problem with an SVD, I would get the same answer. I've converged to what I would have gotten from using a direct solution. And that's what makes me feel comfortable. Right? I know what my solution means. Yeah, I mean, if I could identify which data are really critical for saying whether or not I have a good model, then I would weight those immensely in this thing, and then it would look, have more of the same behavior as that. Yeah. Sure. How often do I retrace the rays? Well, fortunately, I'm only looking at teleseismic waves, and you don't really have to retrace the rays at all. If you're looking at things which turn in the transition zone, upper mantle, then you do. All right? But for us, you don't. And we did this many years ago and tried doing ray tracing, and it makes no difference at all. Most people would say that it's more important to take account of the finite frequency effects of our kind of data, and instead of using rays, to use bananas or banana donuts. And when you do that, it does change the character of the models a little bit. I mean, there are certain aspects of the model which are changed, but if you put in some more data, just add another 1,000 SES minus S measurements, it's going to have much more impact than changing between your theory and something else. So that is a secondary concern. Well, that's something that we have too, right? Our models on these kind of scale lengths that I'm doing the checkerboards on, the models are too small, right? And the problem there is that maybe there's a way to be clever about doing lateral varying damping, all right? So that the sense of your data set is more evenly distributed, which is, again, maybe what Adam was talking about. We have the same issue. If you start wanting to recover small things everywhere, then the places where you don't have data coverage, you're going to have underestimated amplitudes. But hopefully there will be places where you do have data coverage when the amplitude recovery is okay. This is not true of the surface wave problem, by the way, tomorrow, where the coverage is pretty good and you don't actually lose much amplitude in the inversions at all. Yeah.
So the common features.
Oh.
Oh.
Oh, it's a disaster. No. Some people, let me see, are foolish enough to make D in this matrix here be I. Alright, if you make D be I, then it's lambda x transpose x. Alright, so you're minimizing the size of the model vector, the amplitude of the model vector. Now, we're always fighting the fact that we underestimate our model vectors, so actually explicitly damping that is really stupid. And so it's much better to use the difference operator and worry about first difference or second difference smoothing. As soon as you put in a little bit of this with D equal I, you will really underestimate your amplitude. So, what are you laughing at, Alan? Yeah. I usually say on here, never use... Oh, I didn't say it. Oh. Subliminal. I don't have strong opinions about anything. Yeah. Actually, the conjugate gradient technique I showed you there worked on the normal equations, A transpose A, so it was positive definite. But this, the LSQR is working on the rectangular system, so no, it's not. The other question was ellipticity. We actually correct the data for ellipticity. It's actually interesting that if you look at long period surface waves, they don't think the Earth is elliptical, all right? Actually, they don't think the Earth is elliptical at all if you look at a 300 second surface wave. So when you correct the ellipticity, you actually put a negative ellipticity into those data. And so there's a strong P20 component inside the Earth in the upper Magellan transition zone that actually counteracts the ellipticity you'd expect to have. But yeah, we do the reference state has ellipticity in there in the sense that we've done linear corrections for ellipticity. We also do linear corrections for crustal structure. And it turns out crustal structure has quite a large impact on deep structure because it's actually long wavelength. I mean, you know, crustal structure is really common in oceans. And so it can have quite a strong impact on very long wavelength radio waves, and it's really astonishing that it does. So you have to be careful about how you take care of the crust as well in all of these things. Do I have a picture? If you look at, say, the degree 2 part of a phase velocity map for a long period surface wave, then the crust can account for about half that signal in that degree 2 pattern. Maybe a little bit less, a third. So. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, I mean, I would agree to a certain extent. I think unless you're working at very long periods, that's always going to be a problem because the details of the source become more important. And how you actually do waveform modeling becomes important because, you know, cycle skipping and all those other nasty things can come bite you at periods of, you know, 20, 30 seconds. If you're I mean, for things like SS, for example, you can usually get ships that are much more than half a cycle. Yeah, all I'm trying to say is that I think you're right in principle, and certainly right now we can do that, or you can do that long periods. I'm not sure that it's still something that full body waveform modeling. Well, I've said maybe using WKBJ or something like that, something you can do at shorter periods. And I still worry about the effect of the sources. You know, the Harvard CMT at shorter periods is not going to do it. So. Right, but then do you include finite sources or just point sources? Right. Yeah. Well, no, actually, Colleen was going to give her a little research talk. So. Is it? Well, if it's quick. Well, the velocity density scaling probably is pretty meaningless, but if you look at longer wavelength stuff than this, I forget what this is, it's degree 16 or something like that. If you're looking at longer wavelength stuff, degree 8 or something like that, that you might think important in geoid modeling, then the amplitude recovery is much better. So, I mean, I could tell you exactly. Yeah, but it will be much more. It will look much more uniform to you. If I had done this, I'll do that for you. I'll prove it to you. Okay. Are we going to try and do Colleen's talk?